Disc 8.
Runners went into Bastogne and returned with flour sacks and bedsheets, which provided some warmth and camouflage. In the foxholes and on the outposts, men wrapped their bodies in blankets and their boots in burlap. The burlap soaked up the snow. Boots became soggy. Socks got wet. The cold penetrated right into the bones. Shivering was as normal as breathing. The men looked like George Washington's army at Valley Forge, except that they were getting fired upon, had no huts, and warming fires were out of the question. Colonel Ralph Ingersoll, an intelligence officer with First Army, described the penetrating cold. Riding through the Ardennes, I wore woolen underwear, a woolen uniform, Armored Force combat overalls, a sweater, an Armored Force field jacket with elastic cuffs, a muffler, a heavy-lined trench coat, two pairs of heavy woolen socks, and combat boots with galoshes over them, and I cannot remember ever being warm. For the men of Easy, without decent socks and no galoshes, feet always cold and always wet, trench foot quickly became a problem. Corporal Carson remembered being taught that the way to prevent trench foot was to massage the feet, so he took off his boots and massaged his feet. A German shell came in and hit a tree over his foxhole. Splinters tore up his foot and penetrated his thigh. He was evacuated back to Bastogne. At the hospital set up in the town, I looked around and never saw so many wounded men. I called a medic over and said, "Hey, how come you got so many wounded people around here? Aren't we evacuating anybody?" "Haven't you heard?" the medic replied. "I haven't heard a damn thing. They've got us surrounded, the poor bastards." General McAuliffe saw to it that the wounded had booze for comfort. A medic gave Carson a bottle of creme de menthe. I didn't even know what it was, but to this day I have liked creme de menthe. The Luftwaffe bombed the town that night. Carson remembered to get on his hands and knees for the concussion. He got sick. Thank God for that helmet. I had already had about half that creme de menthe. It was all green in my helmet. For the most part, all the men of Easy had to eat was K rations, and not enough of those had been distributed back at Mourmelon. The company cooks tried to bring a hot meal up after darkness, but by the time they reached the men in the foxholes, the food was cold. Mainly, it consisted of white navy beans, which, according to Sergeant Rader, caused gastronomical outbursts that were something to behold. Cook Joe Dominguez found some shortening and cornmeal, which he turned into corn fritters, also stone cold by the time they arrived. The men mixed the lemonade packet in their K-rations with snow to make a dessert. On the line, the days were miserable, the nights worse. The shelling was not continuous. The machine gun fire directed at the Americans was sporadic, but snipers were active through the day. At night, the ominous silence would be broken by the nerve-wracking hammering of enemy mortars, followed by cries from the wounded and calls to man the positions in preparation for an attack. Then another ominous silence. Every 2 hours, the platoon sergeants would wake two men in a foxhole, lead them to the outpost, OP position, to relieve the men on duty. The trip out to the OP was always eerie, Christensen remembered. You eyed all silhouettes suspiciously, skeptical of any sound. Reluctantly, you approach the OP. The silhouettes of the men in their positions are not clear. Are they Germans? The suspense is always the same. Then finally, you recognize an American helmet. Feeling a little ridiculous, yet also relieved, you turn around and return to the main line, only to repeat the entire process in another 2 hours. In the foxholes, the men tried to get some sleep. Difficult to impossible, given the cramped conditions, usually 6 feet by 2 feet by 3 or 4 feet deep for two men. At least lying together allowed the men to exchange body heat. Heffron and Private Al Vittori did manage to get to sleep the second night out. Heffron woke when Vittore threw his heavy leg over his body. When Vittore started to rub Heffron's chest, Heffron gave him a shot with his elbow in his belly. Vittore woke and demanded to know what the hell was going on. Heffron started to give him hell in return. Vittore grinned and said he had been dreaming about his wife. "Al," Heffron said, "I can't help you, as I got combat boots, jump pants, and my trench coat on, and they are not coming off." In other foxholes, men talked to relieve the tension. Sergeant Rader and Private Don Hubler came from the same town on the banks of the Ohio River. Don and I would talk all night about home, our families, people and places, and what the hell were we doing in a predicament like this? Spina recalled discussing with his foxhole mate politics, the world's problems, plus our own, wishing we had a drink or a hot meal, preferably in that order. We talked about what we were going to do when we got home, about a trip to Paris in a couple of weeks, go to the Follies. Mainly, we talked about going home. Sergeant Toya, back from hospital, didn't like the silence at night between mortar attacks. To break it, he would sing. "I'll Be Seeing You" was his favorite. Heffron told him to cut it, that the Krauts would surely hear him. Toya sang anyway. According to Heffron, Joe was a hell of a better soldier than singer. Sitting in front-line foxholes was bad. Being on OP was worse. Going on combat patrol, looking for a fight, was the worst. But it had to be done. It was the inability of 8th Corps to patrol aggressively due to insufficient manpower that had led to the December 16th surprise when the Germans attacked in far greater force than anyone anticipated. On December 21st, Lieutenant Peacock sent Sergeant Martin to the various foxholes of 1st Platoon. At each one holding a sergeant or a corporal, Martin announced, "I want all NCOs back at the platoon CP now." The men gathered. Lieutenant Peacock, the platoon leader, as tense as ever, stopped the grumbling. "At ease. Battalion wants a platoon to go on a combat patrol, and we have been elected to be that platoon." He paused. No one spoke. Peacock went on. "We know the Krauts are in the woods in front of our MLR, but we don't know how many or where their MLR or OPs are located. It's our job to acquire that information and to capture some prisoners if possible." Questions came in a torrent. "What's the plan of attack?" Sergeant Christensen, leader of 1st Squad, wanted to know. "How will the squads be positioned?" asked Sergeant Muck of the Mortar Squad. "What happens when we lose contact in the woods?" wondered 2nd Squad leader Sergeant Randleman. Peacock did not have any ready answers. "You'll know more of what you're going to do when we reach the woods," was all he could think to say. "Son of a bitch," Christensen thought to himself. "This is going to be another snafu operation, with not enough information to fill a pea pod." "We move out at 1300 hours, Peacock concluded. "Damn," was Christensen's thought. "We are being led by Mr. Indecision himself. To infiltrate into the German lines without a good plan is a tremendous, bungling tactical error." But when he met with his squad, he kept his thoughts to himself. He told the men to draw ammunition and be ready to jump off at 1300. At 1200, 1st Platoon fell back a few meters from the MLR and gathered around Father Maloney, who had his communion set out. He announced that he was giving a general absolution. After the men who wanted one received their communion wafer, he wished them good luck. Just before 1300, the platoon assembled in the woods behind the MLR. Peacock looked to Christensen like a frightened rabbit. He had no special orders to give, offered no clarification about a plan. He just announced, "All right, men, let's move out." The platoon moved to the extreme right flank of the battalion, along the railroad tracks. It moved through D Company's position and began advancing toward the Germans, the tracks to the right, the woods to the left. It proceeded slowly, moving in column, stopping frequently. Some 200 meters beyond the MLR, Peacock called the NCOs forward. He gave his orders. Each squad would form a column of twos abreast of one another, send out two scouts on point, proceed into the woods until contact was made. The platoon plunged into the woods. Immediately, the columns lost touch with each other. The squads lost touch with their scouts. The snow was soft, not crunchy, and the silence complete. It was broken by a short burst from a German machine gun. Private John Julian, a scout for 2nd Squad, was hit in the neck, and Private James Welling, scouting for 3rd Squad, was also hit. The machine gunners from Easy set up their weapons and prepared to return fire. Private Robert Burr Smith of 1st Squad opened up with a long burst in the direction of the German firebase. When he paused, the Germans let loose another burst of their own. Christensen shouted for Martin. No answer. For Randleman. No answer. For Peacock. No answer. Only more German fire. The 1st platoon's being decimated, Christensen thought. He shouted again. Bull Randleman came through the woods to answer. Have you seen Martin or Peacock? Randleman had not. Another burst of machine gun fire cut through the trees. We have got to make a move, Randleman said. He joined Chris in calling for Martin. No answer. Let's get the hell out of here, Chris suggested. Bull agreed. They called out the orders to their men and fell back to the railroad. There they met Martin, Peacock, and the remainder of the platoon. The patrol had not been a great success. 1st Platoon had uncovered the German MLR and discovered that the German OPs were thinly manned and stretched out. But it had lost one man, killed, Julian, and one wounded, and failed to bring in a prisoner. It spent the night shivering in the foxholes, eating cold beans and fritters, wondering if the weather would ever clear so that the 101st could be resupplied by air. The next couple of days were about the same. Easy sent out patrols, the Germans sent out patrols, occasional mortar attacks, sporadic machine gun fire, bitter cold, inadequate medical supplies, no hot food, not enough food. Constant shivering was burning off energy that was not being replaced. For the privates, not enough sleep. For the NCOs, almost no sleep. This was survival time, and reactions were slow due to the near-frozen limbs. Shell bursts in the trees sent splinters, limbs, trunks, and metal showering down on the foxholes. To protect themselves, the men tried to cover their holes with logs, but not having axes made it a difficult task. One man solved the problem by putting 2 or 3 German stiffs over the top. Most maddening was the inability of the American artillery to respond to German shelling or to disrupt German activity. Easy's OP men would watch with envy as German trucks and tanks moved back and forth behind the German line, bringing in the shells and food that the Americans so badly missed. Back in Bastogne, the Americans had plenty of guns, including 105 and 155 millimeter howitzers. They had been active the first few days of the siege, firing in a complete circle at all German attempts to break through the MLR. But by the 23rd, they were almost out of ammunition. Winters recalled being told that the single artillery piece covering the Foy-Bastogne road, his left flank, was down to 3 rounds. They were being saved for anti-tank purposes in the event of a German panzer attack down that road. In other words, no artillery support for Easy or 2nd Battalion. This at a time when the men of the company were down to 6 rounds per mortar, 1 bandolier for each rifleman, and 1 box of machine gun ammo per gun. That day, however, the snow stopped, the sky cleared, C-47s dropped supplies, medicine, food, ammunition. American artillery got back into action, curtailing German daytime activity, boosting morale on the MLR. K-rations were distributed, along with ammo. But the .30 caliber for the light machine guns and M1s was insufficient to the needs, and the 24,406 K-rations were enough for only a day or so. Not enough blankets had been dropped to ensure that every man had one. Officers watched for signs of breaking. When Winters sensed that Private Liebgott was on the edge, he brought him back to Battalion CP to be his runner. This gave Liebgott a chance to rest up and get away from the tensions of the MLR. Just being back 50 yards off the front line made a tremendous difference in the tension, Winters wrote. The temptation to stay put when a patrol went out was very strong. Even stronger was the temptation to report back at the aid station with trench foot or frozen feet and hands, or an extreme case of diarrhea. If all the men who had a legitimate reason to leave the MLR and go back to the aid station in Bastogne had taken advantage of their situation, Winters wrote, there just would not have been a front line. It would have been a line of outposts. The temptation to get out altogether via a self-inflicted wound was also strong. It did not get light until 0800. It got dark at 1600. During the 16 hours of night, out in those frozen foxholes, which actually shrank as the night went on and the ground froze and expanded, it was impossible to keep out of the mind the thought of how easy it would be to shoot a round into a foot. A little pain, not much in a foot so cold it could not be felt anyway, and then transport back to Bastogne, a warm aid station, a hot meal, a bed, escape. No man from Easy gave in to that temptation that every one of them felt. One man did take off his boots and socks to get frostbite, and thus a ticket out of there. But for the others, they would take a legitimate way out or none. Winters recalled, when a man was hit hard enough for evacuation, he was usually very happy, and we were happy for him. He had a ticket out to the hospital, or even a ticket home, alive. When a man was killed, he looked so peaceful. His suffering was over. At first light on Christmas Eve morning, Winters inspected his MLR. He walked past Corporal Gordon, his head wrapped in a big towel with his helmet sitting on top. Walter sat on the edge of his foxhole behind his light machine gun. He looked like he was frozen stiff, staring blankly straight ahead at the woods. I stopped and looked back at him, and it suddenly struck me. Damn, Gordon's matured. He's a man. A half hour later, at 0830, Gordon brewed himself a cup of coffee. He kept coffee grounds in his hand grenade canister, and I'd melted the snow with my little gas stove, and I'd brewed up this lovely cup of coffee. As he started to sip it, the outposts came in with the word that a German force was attempting to infiltrate Easy's lines. His squad leader, Sergeant Buck Taylor, told him to get on that machine gun. Gordon brushed snow from his weapon and the ammo box adjacent to the gun, telling his assistant, Private Stephen Grodzki, to look sharp, pay attention to detail. A shot from a German rifleman rang out. The bullet hit Gordon in the left shoulder and exited from the right shoulder. It had brushed his spinal column. He was paralyzed from the neck down. He slid to the bottom of his foxhole. The canteen cup followed me and the hot liquid spilled in my lap. I can see the steam rising upward to this very day. Taylor and Earl McClung went looking for the sniper who had shot Gordon. They found and killed him. Shifty Powers was in the next foxhole. As Shames had hoped would happen, he had recovered completely. Shifty was from Virginia, a mountain man, part Indian. He had spent countless hours as a youth hunting squirrels. He could sense the least little movement in a woods. He spotted a German in a tree, raised his M1, and killed the man. Paul Rogers, Gordon's best friend, Jim Alley, and another member of the 3rd Platoon rushed over to Gordon. They hauled him out of the hole and dragged him back into the woods, in Gordon's words, as a gladiator was dragged from the arena. In a sheltered area, they stretched him out to examine him. Medic Rowe came up, took a quick look, and declared that it was serious. Rowe gave Gordon morphine and prepared to give plasma. Sergeant Lipton came over to see what he could do. Walter's face was ashen and his eyes closed, Lipton recalled. He looked more dead than alive. In the extreme cold, it seemed to Lipton that the plasma was flowing too slowly, so he took the bottle from Rowe and put it under his arm inside his clothes to warm it up. As I looked down at Gordon's face, he suddenly opened his eyes. "Walter, how do you feel?" I asked. "Lipton," he said in a surprisingly strong voice, "you're standing on my hand." I jumped back, looking down, and he was right. I had been standing on his hand. A jeep summoned by radio came up and evacuated Gordon to the aid station. The German attack continued, intensified, was finally thrown back with heavy losses thanks to a combination of Easy's rifle and machine gun fire, mortars and grenades, ably assisted by artillery. Lipton later counted 38 dead German bodies in front of the woods. Lieutenant Welsh was hit and evacuated. On the afternoon of Christmas Eve, the men received General McAuliffe's Christmas greetings. "What's merry about all this, you ask?" was the opening line. "Just this. We have stopped cold everything that has been thrown at us from the north, east, south, and west. We have identifications from 4 German panzer divisions, 2 German infantry divisions, and 1 German parachute division. The Germans surround us. Their radios blare our doom. Their commander demanded our surrender in the following impudent arrogance." There followed the 4-paragraph message to the USA commander of the encircled town of Bastogne from the German commander, demanding an honorable surrender to save the encircled USA troops from total annihilation, dated December 22nd. McAuliffe's message continued. The German commander received the following reply: 22nd December 1944, to the German commander. Nuts, the American commander. We are giving our country and our loved ones at home a worthy Christmas present, and, being privileged to take part in this gallant feat of arms, are truly making for ourselves a Merry Christmas. A.C. McAuliffe, commanding. The men at the front were not as upbeat as General McAuliffe. They had cold white beans for their Christmas Eve dinner, while the division staff had a turkey dinner served on a table with a tablecloth, a small Christmas tree, knives and forks and plates. Out on the MLR, Sergeant Rader was feeling terrible about having to put men out on OP duty on Christmas Eve. His childhood buddy, Corporal Don Hubler, suggested, "Why don't we take that post tonight and just allow the men to sleep? We can lay it off as a kind of Christmas present to the men." Rader agreed. When darkness fell, they moved out to the OP. It was miserably cold, a biting wind taking the wind chill factor well below zero. "As the night wore on, we talked of our homes," Rader remembered, "our families, and how they were spending their Christmas Eve. Don felt sure all of them were in church praying for us." On Christmas Day, the Germans attacked again, but fortunately for E Company on the other side of Bastogne. The following day, Patton's Third Army, spearheaded by Lieutenant Colonel Crichton Abrams of the 37th Tank Battalion, broke through the German lines. The 101st was no longer surrounded. It now had ground communications with the American supply dumps. Soon, trucks were bringing in adequate supplies of food, medicine, and ammunition. The wounded were evacuated to the rear. General Taylor returned. He inspected the front lines, according to Winters, very briskly. His instructions before leaving us were, "Watch those woods in front of you." What the hell did he think we had been doing while he was in Washington? Winters has a thing about Taylor. In one interview, he remarked, "And now you have General Taylor coming back from his Christmas vacation in Washington." I interrupted to say, "That's not quite fair." "Isn't it?" "Well, he was ordered back to testify." Winters cut me off. "I don't want to be fair." The breaking of the siege brought the first newspapers from the outside world. The men of the 101st learned that they had become a legend even as the battle continued. As the division history put it, the legend was aided by the universality of the press and radio, of 10,000 daily maps showing one spot holding out inside the rolling tide of the worst American military debacle of modern times. It was aided by a worried nation's grasping for encouragement and hope. For days it was the one encouraging sight that met their eyes each morning, and the War Department, earlier than was its practice, identified the division inside the town. So even before their bloody month in the town was up, to the world, the 101st became the battered bastards of the Bastion of Bastogne. The elements of drama were there. Courage in the midst of surrounding panic and defeat. Courage and grim humor in the midst of physical suffering, cold, and near-fatal shortages. A surrender demand and a 4-letter word rebuttal. and a real comradeship. Courage and comradeship combined to develop a team that the Germans couldn't whip. Of course, Combat Command B of the 10th Armored Division was also in Bastogne, but it was not identified in the press. And of course, the 82nd Airborne fought as costly and desperate a fight on the northern shoulder of the Bulge, a fight that was at least as significant as the one at Bastogne. But it was not surrounded and never got the publicity the 101st received. The 101st still had a complaint. As the story of the Battle of the Bulge is told today, it is one of George Patton and his Third Army coming to the rescue of the encircled 101st, like the cavalry coming to save the settlers in their wagon circle. No member of the 101st has ever agreed that the division needed to be rescued. With the encirclement broken, the men of the 101st expected to return to Mourmelon to bask in the Allied world's adulation and perhaps celebrate the new year in Paris. But the heroic stand at Bastogne had been a defensive action. To win the war, the Allies were going to have to resume their offensive. The Germans had come out of their fixed positions in the West Wall and made themselves vulnerable. Eisenhower wanted to seize the opportunity. But his problem at the end of December was the same as it had been in the middle of the month, a manpower shortage. The stark truth was that the Germans outnumbered the Allies on the Western Front. The United States had not raised enough infantry divisions to fight a two-front war. This was a consequence of the pre-war decision by the government to be lavish with deferments for industrial and farm labor and to refrain from drafting fathers. There was also a shortage of artillery shells, brought on by a decision in September, when it seemed the war in Europe would be over in a matter of weeks, to lower production of shells on the industrial priority list. To go over to a general offensive, as he had decided to do, Ike needed the 101st and 82nd in the line. It was a question of timing. Eisenhower wanted to attack even before New Year's Eve, but Monty, commanding the forces, all American, on the northern shoulder of the Bulge, stalled and shivered and made excuses, so it did not happen. For Easy, that meant staying in the line. Conditions improved somewhat. The men got overshoes and long underwear and sometimes hot food. But the cold continued. The snow did not go away. The Germans hit the company with mortar and artillery fire daily. Patrols had to be mounted. German patrols had to be turned back. On December 29th, Easy was in the same woods it had occupied for 9 days. With the clear weather, the men on OP duty could see Foy below them and Noville across open fields and along the road about 2 kilometers to the north. Shifty Powers came in from an OP to report to First Sergeant Lipton. "Sergeant," he said, "there's a tree up there toward Noville that wasn't there yesterday." Powers had no binoculars, but Lipton did. Looking through them, Lipton could not see anything unusual, even after Powers pinpointed the spot for him. One reason Lipton had trouble was that the object was not an isolated tree. There were a number of trees along the road in that area. Lipton expressed some doubts, but Powers insisted it had not been there the previous day. Lipton studied the spot with his binoculars. He saw some movement near the tree and then more movement under other trees around it. Then he saw gun barrels, 88s by their appearance, as they were elevated, and 88s were the basic German anti-aircraft weapon as well as ground artillery piece. Lipton realized that the Germans were putting an anti-aircraft battery in among the trees and had put up the tree Powers spotted as part of their camouflage. Lipton put in a call for a forward artillery observer. When he arrived, he saw what Powers and Lipton had seen. He got on the radio, talking to a battery of 105mm back in Bastogne. When he described the target, he had no trouble getting approval for full battery fire, despite the short supply of artillery ammunition. To zero in on the target, the observer called for a round on a position he could locate on his map, about 300 meters to the right of the trees. One gun fired and hit the target. Then he shifted the aim 300 meters to the left and called for all the battery's guns to lay in on the same azimuth and range. When he got a report that all was ready, he had his guns fire for effect several rounds from each gun. Shells started exploding all around the German position. Lipton watched through his binoculars as the Germans scrambled to get out of there, salvaging what they could of their guns, helping wounded to the rear. Within an hour, the place was deserted. It all happened, Lipton summed up, because Shifty saw a tree almost a mile away that hadn't been there the day before. The German 88 battery had been going into place as part of a renewed pressure the Germans were putting on Bastogne. Having failed in their original plan to get across the Meuse River, the Germans needed Bastogne and its road net to hold their position in the Bulge and to be prepared for withdrawal. They launched furious attacks against the narrow corridor leading into the town from the south and increased the pressure all around. By the end of the year, 8 German divisions, including 3 SS Panzer divisions, were fighting in the Bastogne area. Patton's Third Army was attacking north toward Bastogne. U.S. First Army, under General Courtney Hodges, who was under Monty at this time, was scheduled to begin an attack south sometime soon. If they linked up in time, they would cut off the Germans in the Bulge salient. If the Germans could stop Patton's thrust and take Bastogne, they would have the road net that would enable them to escape. That was the situation on New Year's Eve. At midnight, to celebrate the coming of the year of victory and to demonstrate how much things had changed in Bastogne in the past few days, every gun in Bastogne and every mortar piece on the MLR joined in a serenade of high explosives hurled at the Germans. Corporal Gordon, along with more than a dozen other wounded easy men, was evacuated to the rear. Another 7 men from the company lay buried in shallow graves in the woods. Easy had put 121 officers and men on the trucks back to Moumelon 12 days earlier. Its fighting strength was down to less than 100. Gordon was taken by ambulance to Sedan, then flown to England and on to a hospital in Wales. He was heavily sedated, paralyzed, hallucinating. He was placed in a plaster cast from waist to the top of his head. Only his face was left unplastered. But the cast that kept him immobile also prevented treatment of the wounds made by the bullet entering and exiting his back. So it was removed and replaced by the device known as the Crutchfield tongs. The apparatus was applied by boring 2 holes in the crown of his head, then inserting steel tongs into the holes and clamping them into place. A line attached through pulleys provided traction while preventing any movement without the need for a cast. He stayed in that position, flat on his back, gazing up at the ceiling for 6 weeks. Slowly, he began to have some feeling in his extremities. The doctor, Major M.L. Stadium, told him that had the bullet varied 1/2 inch in one direction, it would have missed him. Had it varied that much in the other direction, the wound would have been fatal. Gordon considered himself to be fortunate, very fortunate, a $1 million wound. Only a man who had been in the front line at Bastogne could describe such a wound in such words. Chapter 12. The Breaking Point. Bastogne, January 1st through 13th, 1945. During the siege, Easy had been on the defensive, taking it. The greatest disadvantage to being put on the defensive in the woods was that the pines gave an optimum tree burst to artillery shells. But in other ways, being on the defensive had some decided advantage. By New Year's Day, the snow was a foot deep in some places, frozen on top, slippery. Even the shortest infantry movements were made under the most trying conditions. To advance, a man had to flounder through the snow, bending and squirming to avoid knocking the snow off the branches and revealing his position. Visibility on the ground was limited to a few meters. An attacker had little contact with the men on his left and right, and he could not see a machine gun position or a foxhole until he was almost on top of it. There were no roads, houses, or landmarks in the woods, so an advancing force would report its position by radio only by approximation. Squads on the attack had to move on compass bearings until they bumped into somebody, friend, or enemy. Ammunition boxes for resupply were hand-carried to the foxholes, as always, but in this case by men who had no clear idea of direction. Attacking in the cleared grazing fields was equally daunting. There was only one road, Noville, Foy, Bastogne, and it was ice-coated on top with black ice under the snow. German 88s were zeroed in on the road, which was also mined. But the alternative to attacking down the road was to come cross-country over the fields, which offered no concealment. The cultivated woods that had been home to Easy for 12 days were called the Bois Jacques. They extended to Easy's right, east, a couple of kilometers, to the railroad track and beyond. To its front, north, an open field sloped down to the village of Foy. The Germans held the Bois Jacques to the northeast. Their position was a wedge into the 101st Lines. It was the closest they were anywhere to Bastogne, only 3 kilometers away. Before the 101st could launch any general offensive, the Germans had to be driven from the Bois Jacques and Foy taken. The next objective would be the high ground around Noville. New Year's Day was quiet, but that evening division assigned 2nd Battalion of the 506 the task of attacking and clearing out the Bois Jacques. That night, a few German planes dropped bombs on E Company. Sergeant Toya was hit by a piece of shrapnel on the wrist. This was his third wound. He had been hit in Normandy and then again in Holland. He was a walking wounded. The medic sent him back to the aid station to get patched up. Before leaving, Toya checked in with Sergeant Malarkey, who said in parting, "You lucky SOB." To carry out the attack, at first light on January 2nd, the battalion shifted to its right to the railroad track. 1st Battalion, in regimental reserve, moved into 2nd Battalion's old position. 2nd Battalion formed skirmish lines on the Foy-Bizorry Road, looking to the northeast into the dense woods, waiting for the order to move out. This was the same place from which 1st Platoon had moved out on patrol on December 22nd. A battalion of the 501st was on 2nd Battalion's right. It would be attacking in support. Winters called out the command, "Move out!" The men began to advance. Moving in those dense woods was an exhausting process under the best of circumstances, completely so when carrying rifles, machine guns, mortars, grenades, knives, ammunition, and rations. The struggle to get through caused the body to sweat profusely, which was not a problem until one stopped. After a few minutes, the wet underclothing could chill the body to the bone. Immediately upon plunging into the woods, contact between platoons, even squads, sometimes even man to man, was lost. The snow and trees absorbed the noise so that even the clank of equipment, a sign that the men on each side were advancing with you, was absent. The sense of isolation, coupled with the feeling of tension, to create a fearful anticipation of the inevitable enemy response. Machine gun fire from directly in front hit E Company. Simultaneously, supporting American artillery began to whine over the heads of the men. Immediately, German artillery fired back, but not as counter-battery. The German shells were landing in and on the paratroopers. As quickly as it started, the firing ceased. In Sergeant Christensen's analysis, the denseness of the woods was a bewilderment and confusion to the Krauts, whose visibility was no better than ours. Had they known that 2 battalions were moving toward their position in giant skirmish lines, the shelling and machine gun fire would have been much more intense. The advance resumed. Again, machine gun fire broke out as lead elements began to encounter the German OPs. American artillery resumed firing, salvo after salvo. German counterfire became intense. Cries of, "I'm hit!" and shouts for medics could be heard all along the line. Still the advance continued. Men threw grenades and fired their rifles at Germans retreating through the woods. After covering between 800 and 900 meters, Easy Company men refer to this as the 1,000-yard attack, the attackers came to a logging road through the woods. There most of them halted, but some men penetrated a few meters into the woods on the other side to make certain no Germans were hiding there. Christensen was standing on the road with a few of his first platoon men when suddenly, to the right, there was the most improbable sight. A German soldier on horseback came galloping into view. As the Americans saw him, he saw them. He whirled the horse around and began to retreat. Corporal Hubler quickly got off 3 shots, smiled, and jumped into the air, shouting, "I got him! I got him!" Christensen found himself having the odd thought that he had been hoping the horseman would make his getaway. From over to the left, in the woods across the road, Private Ralph Trapezzano called out, "Hey, Chris, I've got a Kraut." Christensen moved down in his direction, went 5 meters past his position, and cut into the woods, holding his M1 ready to fire with safety off. He approached the German from his right side. There stood a very strong-looking SS trooper, camouflage jacket on, submachine gun in his left hand, his arms hanging straight down his side. But his weapon was pointed at Trapp. Trapp was down in a prone position, with his M1 pointed at the Kraut's chest. There wasn't a hint of fear on the SS trooper's face. Christensen pointed his M1 at the German's chest and told him, in his high school German, to drop his weapon. The German looked in Christensen's eyes and saw he meant to shoot, looked at his rifle and sensed that Christensen was taking up the slack on his trigger. He dropped his submachine gun and raised his hands. Christensen told Trapezzano, "The next time you are confronted with an arrogant son of a bitch like this, shoot the bastard." So far, Easy had been lucky. To its right, the 501st had been attacked while it was attacking. The 26th SS Panzer Grenadier Regiment of the 12th SS Division, Hitlerjugend, hit with tanks, artillery, and infantry, inflicting heavy loss. On Easy's left flank, tanks and infantry from the 9th SS Division hit the other companies of the 502nd. But in Easy's sector, things were relatively quiet. Darkness was coming on. The word went down the line to dig in. The men were harassed by sporadic machine gun fire and occasional artillery bursts, which prompted them to cut branches from the nearest source to cover their foxholes. This was dangerous and difficult because it meant exposure. When machine gun fire or shell fire came in, it was a desperate, mad dash for the foxhole, with adrenaline racing through the body. When the foxhole sanctuary was complete, a man was exhausted, his clothes and body drenched with sweat. Now he sat cold, then colder, then began uncontrollable shivering. "When you were convinced that your body could stand no more," Christensen commented, "you found out that it could." Hubler was in a state of exhilaration after shooting a man on horseback. He moved from one position to another, hands in his pockets, batting the breeze with anyone who would talk. In his right-hand pocket he had a Luger he had picked up on the battlefield. A shot rang out. He had accidentally fired the Luger. The bullet went through his right thigh, severing the main artery. In great pain, Hubler rolled about on the ground, crying out for help. Private Holland and 1st Platoon medic tried to bandage the wound. 2 men carried Hubler back to the aid station, but he died shortly after arrival. It was a severely cold night that never seemed to end. Dawn came slowly. There was no firing. Sergeant Martin came walking down 1st Platoon lines. Although his reputation was that he seldom raised his voice and never gave orders in a harsh tone, this time he said gruffly, biting off the words, "I want all the 1st Platoon non-coms at the platoon CP in 10 minutes. Sergeants Rader, Randleman, Muck, and Christensen, and Corporals Robert Marsh and Thomas McCreary gathered at the CP. Martin suggested that they sit down. Lieutenants Sterling Horner, Peacock, and Foley were there. Horner spoke first. "Your platoon commander, Lieutenant Peacock, has been awarded a 30-day furlough to the States, and he leaves today." He explained that the PR man at Division HQ thought it would be a great idea to send one officer from each regiment involved in the heroic defense of Bastogne to the States for a war bond drive and other publicity purposes. Colonel Sink decided to make the selection by drawing lots. Captain Nixon won. Peacock came in second in the 506th. Nixon said he had already seen the States and didn't want to go, so Peacock got the assignment. Everyone looked at Peacock, who stammered, I have been awarded this furlough, I feel certain, because of the great job you men did in Holland and here, and the only thing I can say is thanks." Sergeant McCreary jumped up, ran to Peacock, and started pumping his hand, saying, "Boy, am I glad to hear you're going home, Lieutenant. That's the best news we've had since we left Mourmelon." Peacock, completely misunderstanding, blushed. He said he felt overwhelmed, that praise from one of the men was the highest praise. The sergeants smiled at each other. They were feeling as happy to see Peacock going as he was to be going. The non-coms felt they had carried his load throughout Holland and the Ardennes. No one tried harder than Peacock, Christensen declared, but it was a job he was not cut out for. Peacock announced that Lieutenant Foley was taking command of the platoon. Then, with a cheery, "Good luck to you all," he was gone. As Peacock left, Father John Maloney brought Joe Toya back from the aid station in Bastogne in his jeep. He dropped Toya off by the road. Toya started walking across the field toward the front line. Winters saw him, his arm in a sling, heading back toward the front. "Where are you going?" Winters asked. "You don't have to go back to the line." "I want to go back with the fellas," Toya replied, and kept walking. That afternoon, January 3rd, Winters pulled 2nd and 3rd platoons, plus an attached bazooka team from the 10th Armored, out of the advanced position. He left 1st Platoon, temporarily attached to D Company, which, like most of the companies in the 101st, was down to 50% or less of authorized strength and needed help to maintain the MLR. 2nd and 3rd Platoons began hiking back to their old positions in the section of the woods overlooking Foix. It was about 15:30. The lead units decided to take a shortcut across the open field to get to the foxholes before dark. The other units followed. The Germans saw them. When the men ducked into the woods, they noticed immediately that the Germans had zeroed artillery in on the position. There were shell holes and branches from tree bursts all around the foxholes. The shell holes were big, indicating heavy artillery, probably 170 millimeters. No one had to give an order. Every man went to work at once to strengthen the cover of his foxhole. Sergeant Lipton grabbed an axe and ran over to the nearest small trees, about 50 meters beyond his foxhole. He heard German guns open in the distance. There was not enough time to get back to his foxhole, so he jumped into a small open hole someone had started to dig and then abandoned. It was so shallow that even when lying flat in it, Lipton's head from his nose up was above ground. So he saw the first shells bursting in the trees. The sound was deafening and terrifying. The ground rocked and pitched as in an earthquake. The men from the bazooka team had no foxholes. Two of them were killed immediately, a number of others wounded. Sergeant Joe Toya was in the open, shouting orders to his men to take cover. "They always said, if you can hear the shells, you'll be okay," he recalled. "I did not hear the shell. It exploded just above him. Shrapnel all but tore off his right leg and hit him in the stomach, chest, and both arms. The shrapnel in his chest area was later removed by two separate operations, taking it out from the back. As suddenly as it began, the shelling stopped. It had been the worst shelling Easy had endured in the war. All through the woods, men were calling out for a medic. Lipton ran back to his foxhole to get his rifle, expecting an infantry attack. He heard someone moaning in the next foxhole. A tree, 16 inches in diameter, had fallen over it. Lipton tried to move the tree, but could not. Help arrived. The men dug around the tree, and Private Shep Howell came out, grinning. Toya yelled for help. He wanted someone to drag him into his foxhole. Sergeant Guarnieri got to him first and began dragging him over the ground. The shelling resumed. The Germans had planned well. As they anticipated, the pause had brought men out of the foxholes to help the wounded. A shell burst over Guarnieri's head. Shrapnel tore into his right leg, mangling it. After a few minutes, the shelling ceased. Lipton came out of his foxhole. Lieutenant Dyke called out to him. "I can still hear him with that deep voice of his," Lipton recalled. "He was about 25 yards away, without his helmet or a weapon. "Sergeant Lipton," he yelled to me. "You get things organized here, and I'll go for help. and with that he left. Lipton began rounding up the men who had not been hit. Some of them were close to breaking. Some were amazingly calm. He sent some to tend to the wounded, others to organize to receive the infantry attack he was sure was coming. Then he went to check on Guarnieri and Toya. Lipton looked down at Guarnieri. Guarnieri looked up and said, "Lip, they got old Guarnieri this time." Malarkey joined them. Guarnieri and Toya, as he recalled, were conscious and calm, no screaming or yelling. Joe says, "Give me a cigarette, Malark." And I lit the cigarette for him. There was a pause in our interview. I urged him to go on. "I don't want to talk about it," Malarkey said. Another pause, and then he continued. Joe smoked, looked at me, and asked, "Jesus, Malark, what does a man have to do to get killed around here?" Stretcher Bearers got to Guarnieri first. As he was being carried away, he called out to Toya, "I told you I'd get back to the States before you." Lieutenant Buck Compton commanded 2nd Platoon. He was very close to his men, too close in the opinion of the officers. Compton was a close friend of mine, Malarkey said. He didn't like the status symbol in the Army. He was more friendly with enlisted men than he ever was with officers. He was especially close to Guarnieri and Toya. When he came out of his foxhole, Compton saw carnage all around him. The nearest wounded were his friends, Guarnieri and Toya, their legs dangling from their bodies, their blood turning the snow bright red all around them. Compton started running to the rear, shouting for medics or help of some kind. He finally calmed down at the aid station. It was found he had a severe case of trench foot. He was evacuated. Compton had won a Silver Star at Brécourt Manor on June 6, 1944. He had been wounded later in Normandy and again in Holland. He had stood up to everything the Germans had thrown at him from December 17th to January 3rd, but the sight of his platoon being decimated, of his two friends torn into pieces, unnerved him. Peacock gone, Dyke taking a walk, Compton gone, one replacement lieutenant who had turned himself in to the aid station with Trenchfoot, which by this time almost every member of the company had, and another who was suspected of shooting himself in the hand. The battalion commander had to be concerned with the problem of the breaking point. Winters related his feelings in an interview. "I had reached that stage in Bastogne where I knew I was going to get it. Sooner or later, I'm going to get it. I just hope the hell it isn't too bad. But there never was a fear in me that I was going to break. I just felt that I was going to be hit sooner or later. But as far as the breaking point, no." After a reflective pause, he went on. "But you don't see people getting hit around you every day, every day, every day, continuing on, and not knowing how long this was going to go on. Is this going to go on forever? Am I ever going to see home again?" For the officer, he continued, with the additional burden of making decisions constantly under pressure, when there had been a deprivation of sleep and inadequate food, it was no wonder men broke. It was the policy of the U.S. Army to keep its rifle companies on the line for long periods, continuously in the case of the companies and infantry divisions, making up losses by individual replacement. This meant that replacements went into combat not with the men they had trained and shipped overseas with, but with strangers. It also meant the veteran could look forward to a release from the dangers threatening him only through death or serious wound. This created a situation of endlessness and hopelessness, as Winters indicated. Combat is a topsy-turvy world. Perfect strangers are going to great lengths to kill you. If they succeed, far from being punished for taking life, they will be rewarded, honored, celebrated. In combat, men stay underground in daylight and do their work in the night. Good health is a curse. Trench foot, pneumonia, severe uncontrollable diarrhea, a broken leg are priceless gifts. There is a limit to how long a man can function effectively in this topsy-turvy world. For some, mental breakdown comes early. Army psychiatrists found that in Normandy, between 10% and 20% of the men in rifle companies suffered some form of mental disorder during the first week and either fled or had to be taken out of the line. Many, of course, return to their units later. For others, visible breakdown never occurs, but nevertheless, effectiveness breaks down. The experiences of men in combat produces emotions stronger than civilians can know. Emotions of terror, panic, anger, sorrow, bewilderment, helplessness, uselessness, and each of these feelings drained energy and mental stability. There is no such thing as getting used to combat, the Army psychiatrist stated in an official report on combat exhaustion. Each moment of combat imposes a strain so great that men will break down in direct relation to the intensity and duration of their exposure. Psychiatric casualties are as inevitable as gunshot and shrapnel wounds in warfare. Most men were ineffective after 180 or even 140 days. The general consensus was that a man reached his peak of effectiveness in the first 90 days of combat, that after that his efficiency began to fall off, and that he became steadily less valuable thereafter until he was completely useless. By January 3, 1945, Easy Company had spent 23 days on the front line in Normandy, 78 in Holland, 15 in Belgium, a total of 116. Statistically, the whole company was in danger of breaking down at any time. There was no German infantry follow-up attack that night, nor in the morning. The medics cleared out the wounded. The bodies of the dead stayed out there, frozen, for several more days. Lieutenant Dyke reappeared. Things got back to normal. On January 5th, E Company was pulled back to regimental reserve south of Foix. There, two men, the acting battalion commander and the first sergeant of E Company, thought about the same problem, the officers of that company. As Winters put it, "I look at the junior officers and my company commanders, and I grind my teeth. Basically, we had weak lieutenants. I didn't have faith in them. What the hell can I do about this?" He knew that if he were lucky enough to get some additional officers, they would be replacements just over from the States, after completing a hurry-up training program. As to the company commander, Winters stated flatly, "Dyke was sent to us as a favorite protege of somebody from Division HQ, and our hands were tied." Winters saw no quick solution. In the meantime, he decided, in a pinch, talk to your sergeants. His first sergeant wanted to talk. Lipton asked for a private conversation. Winters said to meet him in the woods behind Battalion CP that night. They met, and Winters expressed his concern about the company commander. He described Dyke's actions, or lack of them, with damning detail. He ended by saying, "Lieutenant Dyke is going to get a lot of E Company men killed." Winters listened intently, asked a few questions, kept his own counsel. Replacements came in. "I could not believe it," John Martin confessed. "I could not believe that they were going to give us replacements and put us on the attack. I figured, Jesus, they'll take us out of here and give us some clothes or something. But no, they get you some replacements and, come on, boys, let's go. And then that's when we start attacking." He was right. The woods form a U around Foy, with the village smack in the middle. In the attack of January 3rd, the Americans had taken control of the right-hand portion of the U. Next would come an attack on the left-hand portion. On January 9th, the company participated in the clearing operation in the woods west of Foy. Resistance was light. The company reached its objective and dug in. Suddenly a shell burst in the trees, then another and another. They kept coming. Corporal George Lutz was caught out in the open. He began racing toward his foxhole. Sergeant Muck and Private Alex Pankala called out to him to jump in with them, but he decided to get to his own, and with shell bursts all around, splinters and branches and whole trees coming down, made it and dived in. Lipton was sharing a foxhole with Sergeant Bob Mann, the company HQ radio man. The Germans sent over some mail. A shell that was a dud hit just outside their foxhole. Lipton looked at it. Mann lighted a cigarette. Lipton had never smoked, but he asked for one, and that night had his first cigarette. Lutz went to check on Muck and Pankala, the men who had offered to share their foxhole with him. The hole had taken a direct hit. Lutz started digging frantically. He found some pieces of bodies and a part of a sleeping bag. The 101st now held all the woods that encircled Foy from the east, west, and south. But Foy, down in its little valley, was not the objective. Noville and the high ground was. General Taylor had wanted to carry on the January 9th attack right into Noville, but for that he needed tank support, and as the tanks could only operate on the road, he had to have Foy. The village had already changed hands 4 times. The 2nd Battalion of the 506th got selected to take Foy. It was pulled out of the line west of Foy and put back in south of the village. Winters picked Easy to lead the assault. It was a simple, brutal operation. Charge across an open, snow-covered field of some 200 meters in length down into the village, where every window could be a machine gun post, where every German had brick-and-mortar protection. That was all there was to it. No subtlety, no maneuvers. Just charge and get close enough to the enemy to use grenades to root them out of rooms. The key was to get across the field quickly. If the men pressed the attack, if the cover fire was heavy enough, it should be simple. If they paused, it could be costly. Division ordered the attack to kick off at 0900. Winters did not like the timing. He argued for a first light start to reduce exposure, but was turned down. Winters was watching as Easy formed up for the attack. Standing behind him was a platoon leader from Dog Company, 1st Lieutenant Ronald C. Spears. Spears was an officer with a reputation. Slim, fairly tall, dark hair, stern, ruggedly handsome, he cultivated the look of a leader and acted it. One of his fellow D Company junior officers, Lieutenant Tom Gibson, described him as a tough, aggressive, brave, and resourceful rifle platoon leader. His nicknames were Sparky, among his fellow officers, and Bloody, with the enlisted. He had led a bayonet attack and won the Silver Star in Normandy. There were stories. The rumor mill swirled around Lieutenant Spears. No one ever saw it happen with his own eyes, but he knew someone who did. They may be just stories, but they were believed or half-believed by the men of E Company. One story was about the time in Normandy when Spears had a major problem with drinking in his platoon. He put out a blanket order. No more wine. None.
This is the end of Disc 8.